One of today's sponsors is the amazing Uni Dragon. They create and sell premium sets of wooden jigsaw puzzles and offer jigsaw puzzles for both adults and children to entertain all experience levels. Some of my personal favourite jigsaw puzzles from Uni Dragon are the Sakura, which is a gorgeous cherry blossom scene and my personal favourite, Planet Earth, which is a picturesque Earth design as seen from outer space, as well as Milky Wheels, which is a super cool design of colourful wheels. What's awesome about Uni Dragon is that all of their puzzles come in their own unique shape, as opposed to just a rectangular shape or a square shape. This makes them super fun to collect. Jigsaw puzzles really are a great way to pass the time. They're fun and they're a low-stakes activity which can help reduce anxiety and increase your memory and problem-solving skills. Listeners of Morbidology have a special discount code for 10% off their order on Amazon.com. Just click the link to Uni Dragon's Amazon store in my show notes and use the code Morbidology for 10% off your order on Amazon. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. It was a pleasant autumn morning in Haddon Township, New Jersey, on the 13th of October 2015. The homes along the tree-lined streets of Cooper Street and Virginia Avenue were all decorated in preparation for Halloween. That morning, however, residents awoke to police canvassing the streets and a helicopter hovering overhead. Unbeknownst to the locals, something terrible had transpired in their quiet community overnight. Something that would strike fear into the heart of parents across the township. On the 13th of October 2015, police in Haddon Township, New Jersey, received a phone call about a missing child. It was around 6 a.m. when David Criado Jr. reported his three-year-old son, Brandon Link Criado Jr., missing.
911, where's your emergency?
I just woke up and my three-year-old's missing.
Okay, what's your address, sir?
Hold on, he's out. He's out, is he in there? No, he's missing.
All right, and what's your address?
In Haddon Township.
What is it?
Haddon Township.
Haddon Township. Three-year-old boy or girl?
Three-year-old boy. His name is Brendan.
Spell his name for me.
B-R-E-N-B-A-N.
And last name?
Criado, C-R-E-A-T-O.
Okay, and what did you last see him wearing?
He was wearing red pajamas.
Okay, and you didn't hear anything or see anything or nothing like that?
No, I just woke up and he wasn't in my apartment. I don't know if he wandered out or what happened. I don't know where he is. The door was locked. I guess he unlocked it and left.
All right, and your address is?
Yes.
Okay, you already had the police on the way, sir. What is your name?
My name is DJ.
DJ, your last name?
Criado.
Spell for me.
C-R-E-A-T-O.
All right, sir, do me a favor. Just hold on. I already had the police on the way. Don't hang up.
All right, thank you.
I want to see if the police dispatcher wants to speak to you, okay?
All right, sir.
All right, stay on the phone.
All right, the police are on their way. The top door was locked and the bottom door was locked. He was unlocked, the doors was left. I don't know what happened.
David informed the operator that he had awoken in the morning to find out that his son was missing from his apartment on Cooper Street and Virginia Avenue. He suggested that Brandon could have unlocked the apartment door and wandered off, adding that he was probably still in his pajamas. A search party was immediately assembled while a missing persons report was filed. An automated alert from police was sent to residents, and they immediately flocked to the streets to help search. They searched their own backyards, their sheds, and their cars. Brian Huber, one local, said, "We all started looking, but instantly we had that bad feeling from the beginning." David would come down to the police station for an interview, and he was inconsolable.
"I have nothing right now, okay?
So much time has passed.
Absolutely. I told you before, I know you don't see a lot of it and we're all standing, but we have resources in the air. We have everybody working on this thing.
I know. Listen, you're working diligent, okay? I'm waiting on word, and believe me, I'd love to be out there myself.
He questioned me. I still work as a pilot, and he said, there's no big problem. I'm not sure about it. It's making me feel like they're not attention. They're just not telling me yet.
Listen. Let's relax. Can I get you a drink of water? You should take a deep breath.
If you want to see the entire interview, it's up on the Vodacast app. Around 3 hours later, there was a tragic update in this search, when it was announced that a police dog had found Brandon's body in Cooper River Park, located around half a mile away from his father's apartment. He was found in a wooded area near the Cooper River. He was found wearing his pajamas and a pair of neon socks. His body was sent off for an autopsy and a cause of death to be determined. Those who knew the area where Brandon's body was discovered said that it was an area full of dangers. There were stairs that led to a small concrete landing that then dropped off into the water of a branch of the Cooper River. You can see a photograph of the area up on the Vodacast app. Brandon was known as a fun and playful little boy. He was always extremely energetic and always happy. He loved Yellow Submarine and Strawberry Fields by the Beatles, and loved playing with his Lego. Just recently, Brandon had developed a love of superheroes, in particular, the Hulk and Iron Man. Quite often, Brandon would wear the costumes of both superheroes at the same time. David and Brandon's mother, Samantha DeNoto, had met while students of Haddon Township High School, where they both graduated in 2011. Shortly after their graduation, Samantha became pregnant. David quite often proudly showed his son off on Facebook. From the moment he found out that Samantha was pregnant, he provided his friends with updates of the pregnancy, the birth, and then Brandon's life as a toddler. The couple stayed together until Brandon was 2 years old, before separating. Samantha lived near David and the couple shared custody. Their custody agreement had not been court ordered, and while the couple were no longer together, they were said to be amicable. Around 150 people gathered for a candlelight vigil following the grim discovery. They walked from the Blessed Teresa of Calcutta Parish on Virginia Avenue to the apartment where Brandon had disappeared from. Here, they recited a prayer and spoke about Brandon and how excited he was to be the Hulk for Halloween. While a cause of death had not yet been established, two close friends of the family stated that the family believed that a stranger had caused Brandon's death. Bernadette Ferrero, whose son was Brandon's godfather, said, "A stranger and an evil person came in and did this." She also said that Brandon's father, David, had chosen not to get a lawyer because he was not involved in his son's death. Donna Duca, who lived in the neighbourhood, would echo this sentiment and say that she too thought a stranger had caused Brandon's death. She said that she felt as though they had been infiltrated by something horrible and that the family did not deserve what had happened, adding that Brandon was just a joy. Some even suggested that a commotion could have lured Brandon outside. However, according to neighbours, nobody heard anything in the hours leading up to Brandon's disappearance, nor did police respond to any other calls in the area that morning. One neighbour, Mary Rudderow, said that she had her windows open that night and that she had two big dogs, who would have barked if there was any kind of commotion outside. They had been silent the entire night and morning. While the area that Brandon's body had been found could be dangerous for a child, those who knew Brandon said that there was just no way he would have gone out there himself. Somebody must have taken him there, or at least lured him there. They said that Brandon knew how to open the apartment door himself, but had never done it when he wasn't being watched. Anita Brown, who lived in the area, said after the service, "Please try to find it in your heart to forgive the perpetrator, because they too need our help." Following the discovery of Brandon's body, his mother Samantha released a statement which read, "We are heartbroken by the loss of our beautiful boy, Brandon Criado, along with Criado family, who has lost a son and grandson. We are grieving and tremendously saddened." She also thanked people for helping in the search for Brandon, as well as thanked those who had showed up to the vigil in his memory. After the autopsy was complete, Camden County prosecutor spokesman Andy McNeil said that the autopsy hadn't established cause or manner of death for Brandon. However, he said that the final autopsy results were pending, and they could hopefully offer more of an insight into how Brandon had died. He refused to say whether they believed that foul play was involved or not, and he refused to say whether there were any clear signs of injury to Brandon. A GoFundMe was set up to raise money for Samantha, so that she could pay for a funeral for her son, and a makeshift memorial appeared outside the apartment where Brandon had disappeared from. Stuffed animals, candles, and flowers piled up on the sidewalk outside. A shrine, which consisted of a single stuffed animal and a candle, also appeared near where Brandon's body was discovered. Some locals took to securing large blue bows to trees in the area as a way to commemorate Brandon's short life. Investigators had remained very tight-lipped about their investigation, but many speculated that they were looking into whether a stranger had come into the apartment and abducted Brandon. Brandon didn't have his own bedroom in the apartment and would sleep on a couch near the front door. According to those who knew the apartment, it was located on the second floor, and that a person must initially enter a door on the first floor to get inside the building, which had 7 apartment units. It certainly seemed unlikely that a 3-year-old would have been able to unlock both apartment doors and wander away on his own. Brandon had spent time between his father's home, his mother's home, and his grandparents' home, and they all lived within a block of each other. At around 8:30 p.m. on the Monday before Brandon vanished, David's mother and father, Lisa and David Criado, dropped Brandon off at David's apartment. After Brandon arrived, David said that he read Brandon 3 books, ate some potato chips, and then went to bed at around 10 p.m. At 6 a.m. the following morning, David woke up for work to find that Brandon was gone. So it was at some point between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. that Brandon had disappeared. With no information being released by investigators working on the case, the rumour mill soon began to run rampant. Whispers about David began swirling around the area, mainly in regards to the 911 call, which by this point had been made public. A lot of people said that David appeared to be extremely calm in the phone call, despite the fact his young son had vanished from the apartment. A number of David's friends would rally around him and defend him. Vera Samach, who had known the family for years, said that to him, David sounded pretty desperate on the phone call. While it wasn't yet determined if Brandon had been the victim of a crime or not, the case had stirred anxiety among the locals, in particular parents. David's lawyer, Richard Fischino Jr., would speak up and say that David was not considered a suspect in his son's death. He said that he had been hired the day Brandon was found dead, after David's family encouraged him to hire a lawyer. He said that investigators had told him on the very first day that David was not considered a suspect. He stated, "The police have told me unequivocally that there are no suspects, that my client is not a suspect, and that they're trying to piece together what happened here." He said that David had a lengthy interview with investigators without a lawyer present. It was during this interview that David had been informed that his son's body had been found.
No, 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 me to tell you this.
I'm sorry, sir.
My best friend. I love him so much. What happened?
Well, we're trying to find out, okay?
Where was he?
He sailed along the shoreline.
The shoreline of what?
River.
Oh, God. Did he drown?
What's that?
Did he drown?
Well, we don't know that this time. So we're trying to find
out. Oh, my God. What do I do? What do I do? Where's my wife?
His lawyer also lambasted people on social media, who were commenting that David was somehow involved in his son's death. According to a family friend, David had hired a lawyer to help him navigate through the unfamiliar legal process, not because he had anything to hide. Defence Fushino spoke about the numerous rumours regarding his client and said that David had sounded so calm in the 911 call because he simply believed that his son was somewhere near the apartment. He said that at first nobody ever thinks that the worst has happened, adding that it would be astonishing to him if he had any level of terror in his voice, which suggested he knew more than he did. Investigators would then come forward to release some more information about the case. They said that there had been no sign of forced entry into the apartment, and also said that Brandon had not been sexually assaulted. They would also announce that the county medical examiner had requested the assistance of two outside experts who could review Brandon's autopsy. On the 23rd of October, mourners gathered at the Blake Doyle Funeral Home, located on Collings Avenue in Collingswood, for a private viewing. Following the viewing, a private funeral mass was held at Holy Saviour Church in Westmont. The funeral had been paid for entirely by donations from locals. Early the following month, the toxicology report would come back, and it would fail to offer any further insight into how Brandon had died. It had come back negative, meaning that no drugs or other chemicals had been found in Brandon's system. With the investigation still being kept under wraps, Brandon's death remained engulfed in rumour and speculation. A local claimed that they had seen a mysterious man pushing a baby stroller the morning Brandon vanished, and somebody else found a discarded baby stroller in the backyard of an abandoned home in the neighbourhood. The rumours would then escalate, with people saying that the man with the baby stroller that morning was Peter O'Connor, who employed Brandon's mother Samantha at the Fair Share Housing Centre, which was a non-profit in Cherry Hill. Peter called them claims totally ridiculous and said that he had been at a memorial service that morning. He publicly stated that investigators had not asked him to speak in relation to the case or his whereabouts that morning. It seemed that the general consensus of the locals was that either David had somehow killed his son or somebody else had. Very few people believed that this was just a tragic accident, with investigators refusing to release any information about the progress of the case. People weren't sure if they should be extra cautious, if there was a potential killer in the midst. The community would soon come to learn that David had been dating 17-year-old Julia Stensky, and Julia had written in her Tumblr account a very suspicious post. It read, "I'm possibly a suspect in a homicide investigation. I was advised by my attorney not to speak to anyone about my case. My boyfriend is in worse trouble than I am and can't leave the state he's in. I can't talk to my parents or anyone else in my family. Not that anyone else knows what happened." Julia lived in New York but occasionally stayed overnight with David on weekends. On the weekend before Brandon had vanished, she stayed at David's apartment. But when David's parents had dropped Brandon off, she had left by this point. The weeks would slowly turn to months, and no new information would be publicised. David's attorneys, as well as the attorneys of his parents, would share their displeasure with how quiet the investigators had remained. If they had uncovered any evidence or received any tips, they had certainly kept it under wraps. However, the new year would finally bring new information, when it was revealed that David had been arrested and charged with his son's murder. It would be revealed that while investigators had been holding their cards close to their chest, they had been looking at David as a suspect from the very beginning. During his arraignment on the murder charge, it would be revealed that the county grand jury have been presented the evidence and then handed down a first-degree murder indictment. It would also be revealed that investigators believed that David had murdered his son because he felt as though he had an impediment on his relationship with 17-year-old Julie. During the hearing, prosecutors stated that Brendan had suffered homicidal violence, akin to smothering or strangulation. There had been indications that Brendan had been deprived of oxygen, and he had some bruising to the right clavicle. Prosecutors would state that Julie resented the fact that David was still interacting with his ex, Samantha, who was the mother of Brendan. The couple had shared custody, so of course there was going to be interaction. They said they believed that David had acted in a rage of jealousy because Julie had told him the weekend before Brendan vanished that she planned on breaking up with him, and he was terrified that she would begin dating somebody else. David sat emotionless as Prosecutor Christine Shah asked the main question that had been on everyone's mind for almost 3 months. She said, "Why would someone kill their own child? There must be a reason for someone to do something like that." She then laid out the circumstantial case against David. She picked apart David's story of a locked apartment door and Brendan wandering off on his own. She also revealed that Julie had made it abundantly clear that she didn't like children and despised the fact that David had spent so much time with his son and was in contact with Samantha. She revealed that Julie had gone off to college and struck up a relationship with another man, which caused David to become unnaturally jealous and paranoid, and that Julie was annoyed that when they were together at weekends, Brendan was always there. Investigators had discovered about the fraught relationship between the couple very early on in the investigation, mainly through numerous text messages and online postings. Assistant Prosecutor Shah said that Julie had issued an ultimatum to David, either give up taking custody of Brendan each weekend or not be with her. She spoke about the 911 call David had placed and said that his voice had a flat effect and tone, adding that Brendan was extremely afraid of the dark, to the point that he would even be reluctant to go to the bathroom at night. She said that the stretch between David's apartment and the location Brendan's body was discovered was extremely dark at night, very steep and difficult to negotiate. She said that David had been sleeping less than 9 feet from the apartment's front door and would have awoken if anybody unlocked the door. She acknowledged their case was very circumstantial but said that the circumstances were extremely compelling. It was revealed that David had lived much of his life online. He had met Julia on Tinder in June. Investigators had examined 9,487 text messages between him and Julie, and had examined Julie's Tumblr blog, where she had written a series of unbelievable blogs in which she described her strong hatred of children. On the night that Brendan was killed, David had called Julie 8 times and had also accessed her Snapchat, and found messages from the guy from her college that David was extremely jealous of. David had told investigators that he had gone to bed at 10 p.m. that night, but he was checking his phone at 1:31 a.m. When Julie had been interviewed by investigators, she revealed that the spot where Brendan had been found was a place that they had visited numerous times as a couple, and a place that David referred to as somewhere spiritual to him. Prosecutor Shah also stated that it was evident that Brendan had been placed in the location where he was found because his socks had no dirt or mud on them, like one would expect if he had wandered there himself. David was ordered to be held on $750,000 bail. His defense attorney, Richard Fuscio, sought a much lower figure and lambasted the prosecution's case as weak and purely circumstantial. He noted that David had been cooperative with the investigators and would not flee. He even suggested that David had become the victim of a witch hunt because pressure from the public had been mounting for a suspect to be identified, and because there were no other obvious leads in the case. He stated that he feared that David's charges were just the result of not having any other answers. Outside of court, David's parents said that they were going to be supporting their son. The arrest came as a relief to the community, but a lot of people had mixed emotions. While the notion that a child killer was lurking among the community, potentially seeking out another victim, was an absolutely terrifying notion. The notion that Brandon's own father, the man who he loved and trusted, had killed him was absolutely soul-destroying. Paula Williamson, who had a 3-year-old grandson, spoke with the Philadelphia Inquirer and said that she felt safe, but said that the arrest was constantly playing on her mind. Viola Hamlin, who lived near where Brandon's body was found, said that her grandchildren were afraid to be alone, and they were now driven to school instead of catching the school bus. She said that a lot of children in the area had lost their sense of safety. Do you grind your teeth in your sleep? If so, you're one of the 40 million Americans who do. There are a number of causes, such as stress, anxiety, or even an abnormal bite. Grinding your teeth can sadly cause a number of problems, such as worn enamel, tooth decay, sleeplessness, and expensive dental problems. According to dentists, the number one teeth grinding prevention is a custom-fitted night guard. However, these can be very costly, with the average dentist charging around $200 to $300 per night guard, and you can grind through several of those a year. That's where today's sponsor, Smile Brilliant, comes in. Smile Brilliant uses a lab direct process to bring you the same custom fitted night guard, but for as little as $45 per night guard. In addition, they also have custom fitted whitening trays and the Carry Pro electronic toothbrush. For me personally, taking care of my teeth is of utmost importance, and Smile Brilliant make it straightforward and affordable. Just head on over to smilebrilliant.com and use the promo code Morbidology to check out for 30% off. Once again, that's smilebrilliant.com and use code Morbidology for 30% off your order. Today's episode is sponsored by the amazing Curiosity Stream, which is available on all major connected TV platforms, such as Roku, Fire Stick, Apple TV, and Android TV, among others. It's also available on mobile apps and on your laptop or computer. Curiosity Stream offers thousands of documentary films and non-fiction TV shows, from mystery and crime to nature, food, science, and history, and everything in between. I've been watching it practically every single day for the last couple of weeks. I would definitely recommend checking out Dark Web, Fighting Cybercrime, and Crime Scene Solvers. All of the documentaries and shows are factual and offer content for children as well as original programming, including David Attenborough's Light on Earth and Stephen Hawking's Favourite Places. Curiosity Stream is the best value in streaming at only $19.99 per year. So head on over to curiositystream.com today. Early the following month, David pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder and second-degree endangering the welfare of a child during a status conference. David's defense lawyer would later file motions asking that the murder charge against him be thrown out. He said that the investigators had failed to read David his Miranda rights before interviewing him. He also said that the medical examiner did not examine the scene where Brandon's body was found until days later. According to the state's Medical Examiner Act, a medical examiner or assistant medical examiner must inspect crime scenes. It wasn't clear why Camden County Medical Examiner Gerald Fagan didn't respond to the scene until days later, but his report revealed that Brandon had been found partially submerged in the creek. It read, "His head and torso were not underwater. His arms and lower legs were underwater. He was clothed in pajamas and his diaper was pulled down, exposing his buttocks. His socks were on and did not appear to be soiled." The motion filed by Defence Fuscino included a transcript of an interview between David and investigators shortly after Brandon's body had been found. During the interview, Haddon Township Police Detective Don Quinn pressed David to speak, stating, "We want to clear you." David responded by saying that he wanted to see his family and wanted to know what had happened to his son. Defence Fuscino wanted to prevent prosecutors from using the interview as evidence against David. He alleged that investigators never informed David that he was a suspect during his 12 hours in police custody, and also suggested that investigators had not produced a shred of competent evidence against David. According to Defence Fuscino, David was read a Miranda-like colloquy, to which David replied, "Ah, I don't understand that wording." The motion also revealed that David had agreed to take a polygraph test, but didn't reveal if he had actually taken one or not. It was also revealed that no adult or children footprints were found at the crime scene. The prosecution would file their own motions opposing the motions of Defence Fushino. Their motion would reveal that when investigating the case, they had a three-year-old girl walk from David's apartment to the location where Brendan's body was found, wearing socks similar to Brendan's. The result was that her socks became filthy. Their motion also revealed that when David had taken a polygraph test and the results came back that he was being untruthful, he asked to take it again. County Medical Examiner Gerald Fagan, who had performed the autopsy, had said to the grand jury that the case was a difficult one because there was no evident cause of death. He said that Brendan's brain showed evidence of oxygen deprivation and said that he and his team had to look at the organs for anything which could indicate that Brendan's death was accidental. He said that there were none. He also said that the lack of dirt on Brendan's socks had been a large factor in the case as well. State Superior Court Judge John Kelly would ultimately refuse to dismiss the murder charge. However, he would agree to see further evidence from the defence on why they think the portions of David's interview with investigators should be suppressed. The decision deeply upset David and his defence lawyer. The prosecution had contended that the medical examiner had followed the state's Medical Examiner Act. However, Defence Fushino said that the state law required that the county medical examiner should have been the one commanding the potential crime scene the moment it was discovered. But Brendan's body had been removed by trained crime scene detectives. He showed his disdain by stating, "Any way you slice it, the little boy deserved better than what he got from the medical examiner's office." David would appear in court next in June, and at this hearing, he rejected a 35-year plea deal and instead opted to stand trial for the murder of his son. During the same hearing, the judge rejected the defense's arguments that David's interview with investigators should be suppressed because David wasn't properly read his Miranda rights. He was ordered to stand trial in January of 2017. There had been a bit of a delay in the case because the defence said that they were still preparing their case. Outside of court, Defence Fushino said, "It's a shame for this father who now stands accused of a crime he didn't commit. This isn't something you do lightly. We don't want to be hasty. We don't want to rush this. This is as serious as it gets." Before the year of 2016 came to an end, a bench and three trees in Cooper River Park, where Brendan's body was discovered, were dedicated to his memory. Friends and family gathered at the spot where Camden County freeholder Jeff Nash said that he hoped the area would be a place where people could come and fondly remember Brendan. Samantha had worked with the county to have the memorial installed. At the gathering, Brendan was described as a ball of joy with an infectious smile. The plaque on the bench did not bore Brendan's name, but instead, Samantha decided to engrave lyrics from the song Lost Boys by Ruth B, because Brendan was obsessed with pirates and Captain Hook from Peter Pan. The plaque simply reads, "Captain Hook, you are my perfect storybook. Neverland, I love you so, you are now my home sweet home." Anticipation for the murder trial was rife. Many people were hoping that the trial could answer the many questions that still lingered. However, just days before the trial was ready to begin, it was delayed. The reason was that Defence Fushino was in the process of having a pathologist write a report regarding the death of Brendan. He would be pushed back until mid-April. During opening statements of the murder trial, Assistant Prosecutor Christine Shah revealed that David had said that he believed a spirit had drawn Brendan to the woods where his body was found. He had said this to Samantha around a month after Brendan was found. Prosecutor Shah said that this reasoning was completely odd and unexplainable. She told the jury that they believed that David had murdered his son after being consumed with jealousy and fear that Julie was going to leave him. She revealed that Julie did not want Brendan to be around when she was there, and David had replied to her, "I don't have a choice." Julie responded by saying, "I want you to not have a kid in your life."
In the beginning of September, end of August, beginning of September, Julian left for school. She went up to New York, went to Manhattan. Within just a few weeks, the defendant was jealous, and he was thinking that Julia was talking to guys at school, and she was. And the defendant even knows which guys Julia was talking to, because he used to check her phone all the time. As we move into October, it continues to deteriorate. On October the 6th, which was a Tuesday, there are close to 600 text messages back and forth between the two. There are so many text messages on that day that we're gonna have a technical person present them to you in a format that is more bearable than just listening to someone read them. They have them entered into a program so that they can be read and almost look like a screen. But at that time, even though it's only Tuesday, Julia is already fighting with the defendant about the upcoming weekend. The upcoming weekend is Columbus Day weekend, and it's the defendant's weekend to have Brendan. And Julia doesn't like Brendan. She wants to avoid seeing him. The defendant texted to her, "I don't have a choice. If I don't have him every other weekend, I go to court and have child support, and I can't afford that." He continues to tell her, though, that he wants to see her. Julia says to him, "Well, we all don't get what we want." And then he starts begging. He says, "Please." And then she doesn't respond, so he says to her, "Yes, we can all get what we want." And Julia says, "Okay, I want you to not have a kid in your life. Do I get that? Or no?" And the defendant replied, "We can always get what we want in the future, but not the past." They are still fighting a few days later, and she wants to go camping in Goshen, Pennsylvania. The defendant suggests that Brendan go camping with them on Friday night, and that he will then drop Brendan off with his mom on Saturday. Julia says to him, "I'm going to Goshen to avoid your kid, so don't you dare bring him here. If you do, I'll cancel the reservation and stay in New York."
She said that it was highly unlikely that Brendan would have left the apartment himself and walked down to the location that he was found. Brendan was afraid of the dark after all, and his socks were completely clean. She revealed that when Brendan was found, one of his pant legs had been hiked up, something she said can happen when a toddler is carried by an adult. You can watch the opening statements up on the Vodacast app. During his opening statements, Defense Fushino said, "I represent an innocent person." He said that David loved his son, and while his spiritual nature may have made people feel uncomfortable, it did not mean that he was guilty. He said that the prosecution had a complete lack of evidence to back up their theories, adding that there was not going to be enough evidence to find David guilty of his son's murder. He pointed out that the burden of proof was on the prosecution, so they did not need to point to somebody else as the killer of Brendan.
"Ladies and gentlemen, you are going to hear some evidence that suggests E.J. Fiato didn't have a lot of money. You're going to hear evidence that suggests his parents don't have a lot of money. You're going to hear evidence that he was jealous that his girlfriend may have had another boyfriend or some other woman. But you are not going to hear, you're not going to hear anything to suggest that he ever did anything but love his son, that he did anything but take care of his son. And if he wanted out, you're going to hear evidence that nobody's going to come. In fact, you're going to hear evidence, ladies and gentlemen, that sometime in 2013, he had to get away for a little while. His son was about a year and a half, and he moved to California. His parents just picked up the slack. The boy's mother just picked up the slack. No one asked for anything. Nobody had brought him into court. Nobody said, 'I'm going to sue you.' He wanted out. He wanted out. DJ's parents, Brendan's parents, they took care of this boy just as much as anybody. As Misha has already told you, you're going to hear evidence that when his girlfriend says, 'Hey, I don't want your son around anymore,' his response is, 'Let's go catch him.' Does that sound like evidence that's going to suggest he was going to get rid of him?"
The first witness to be called to testify was Samantha. She told the jury that the last time she saw her son, she handed David a money order to put in Brendan's backpack to pay for preschool the following day. Both David and Samantha paid for Brendan's preschool. She said that she kissed her son goodbye and went out to get pizza with her boyfriend. When Defence Fushino asked Samantha whether prosecutors had to persuade her that David had killed their son, she said that she had been able to draw her own conclusions about what had happened. She revealed that investigators on the case had asked her to secretly record a conversation with David on the 12th of November 2015, to which she agreed. During this talk, David said that the front door was locked. He put his son to bed on the couch and then went to bed himself. He said that in the morning the door was unlocked and Brendan must have wandered off himself. He then said to Samantha that maybe the spirits had told Brendan to walk down to the woods. David had told Samantha that the area where Brendan's body was found was a very sacred and spiritual spot. Under cross-examination, Samantha confirmed that David was a gentle and soft-spoken man, and she had never once seen him raise a hand to his son. She agreed with the defence that David appeared to be a loving father.
And up until the time that he'd left, was he a supportive and good father and good partner to you taking care of the kid?
Supportive father, yes. There are reasons why we broke up.
I understand that. And look, I realize that I have to get into some of your personal affairs here, and I don't mean to any more than I absolutely have to. But without getting into the specifics of your relationship, he took good care of Brent. He was sweet and loving the way a father should be to his son, wasn't he? You never had any doubts that he loved his son, did you?
No.
In fact, is it fair to say, Ms. Donato, in the course of those 10 or 12 meetings that you had with the prosecution, they had to convince you that DJ did this?
Not necessarily, no.
They did not have to convince you that?
No.
You thought that on your own?
In the situations that I can create of what I think can happen, I can come up with my own conclusion of what's possible and what's not possible.
Defence Fushino had asked Samantha about Brendan having behavioural issues at preschool. However, it wasn't clear how this was relevant to the case. Samantha said that Brendan acted out at times, refusing to listen and hitting others. He had been doing play therapy 3 or 4 times a week in the last few weeks of his life. On the first day of the trial, testimony would also be heard from Sergeant Lance Saunders of the Camden County Prosecutor's Office Homicide Unit, Camden County Chief of Communications James Janowski, and Haddon Township Patrolman Kirk Ernie. Sergeant Saunders and Patrolman Ernie said that David had calmly answered all of the questions they had presented him and allowed them to search his apartment and his car. Patrolman Ernie said that David had told them that he locked the apartment door that night and that nobody else had a key. He also told him that Brendan knew how to unlock the front door. Their testimony would be followed by emotional testimony from Officer Constance Nicholson, the officer who had found Brendan's body. She said that when she began the search with her canine partner, she was hopeful that Brendan would be found alive. She said that she had worn a jacket because it was chilly that morning and thought that when she found Brendan, she could put it on him. She told jurors that her canine partner tracked Brendan's scent down Cooper Street into Cooper River Park, across a field and then down a path to the creek. She became upset and wiped away tears as she testified about finding Brendan's body. She grabbed a tissue as she said, "I saw a small child lying in the water." Lisa Creato, David's mother, would testify next. She said that she sometimes visited psychics and, much like her son, believed in spirits. She started to cry as photographs of her grandson's pajamas, which his aunt had dressed him in the night before he disappeared, were displayed. She said that the night that Brendan disappeared, she had dropped him back at David's apartment after giving him a bath. She said that the exterior back door to his apartment was unlocked, but she said after she dropped Brendan off, she locked it on her way out. She also testified that she kept a screwdriver handy when going to David's apartment, because if the exterior back door was locked, she could pop the lock with the screwdriver. She said there was another interior door from the hallway to David's apartment and said that it was not locked when she left, shortly before 9 p.m., Under cross-examination, Lisa testified that Brendan could unlock doors, and that when he was at her home, he sometimes let himself into the backyard without permission or supervision. She admitted that it never happened at night, though. Prosecutor Shah asked Lisa if her grandson was afraid of the dark, and she confirmed that he was, and he liked to sleep with the light on outside his bedroom. The jury would be taken out to the area where Brendan's body had been found. The prosecution wanted to show that Brendan could not have walked to the area on his own, especially not in the middle of the night. They were led there by Delaware River Port Authority Sergeant John Quigley. The spot where Brendan was found was marked with an orange cone. They were then taken briefly to David's apartment, but they were not allowed to leave the bus to view inside the apartment. The jury would then be shown photographs of Brendan's body, while lead detective Michael Rhodes said that when he immediately suspected foul play when Brendan's body was discovered, he did not initially believe that David was a suspect until 1 or 2 weeks later. He said that the position of Brendan's body indicated to him that he had been placed there. He was lying on his stomach on a rock on the banks of the creek. He said, the back of his pants were rolled inwards and down, where his buttocks were exposed. It seemed like he was placed there, and that was used, possibly, as a grip. He said that when David was questioned, he had access to a lunchroom and the restroom, and could leave at any point. Under cross-examination, Defence Fushino presented the officer with a transcript of the interview, and pointed out that at 6:40 p.m, David had asked to see his family. Detective Rhodes and another detective essentially told him that he could see them soon, but he didn't leave until over 2 hours later. Defence Fushino was focusing on the lengthy interview David had with investigators to highlight his theory that the investigation was flawed, because investigators believed that David was guilty from the very beginning and didn't look into any other potential suspects. Detective Rhodes would testify that they had found and questioned a college student who had been seen in the area with a wheeled suitcase in the morning Brendan was found. They also found and conducted DNA testing on a stroller after rumours circulated that somebody was seen pushing a stroller in the area that morning. The DNA didn't match David or Brendan. They had searched through a trash truck's contents to see if there was any evidence, and he also revealed that they had found fresh cigarette butts at the scene, but could not find a DNA match. The DNA did not belong to David, Julie, or any family member. Detective Rhodes would also reveal that David had told investigators that he had been to the park where Brendan's body was found a couple of times, but said he had never been to the exact spot where Brendan was found. He also said that he was last in the park around a week earlier. However, when David's phone was examined, they found a time-stamped photograph taken 2 days before Brendan died, around 15 yards from the very spot where his body was found. Camden County Medical Examiner Gerald Fagan would be called to testify in regards to the autopsy. He said that he concluded that Brendan had died from homicidal violence, but said that he could not determine where or when he was killed. He revealed that an examination of Brendan's brain showed an abnormality which was consistent with oxygen deprivation that can be caused by asphyxiation, drowning, or strangulation. He said he could not determine which of these three had led to Brendan's death. The signs of oxygen deprivation include edema or swelling in the lungs and swelling and darkening of the grey matter in the brain. He noted in his autopsy report that because Brendan's socks were clean, it was evident that he had not gotten there of his own power and was instead placed there. Defence Fushino didn't hold back when it came time to cross-examine Dr. Fagan. He mentioned how the pathologist didn't go to the crime scene straight away, but instead trusted his medical investigators. He pointed out that recently those medical investigators had been in trouble for leaving behind a severed hand at a fatal accident scene for the family to find it just days later. He also pointed out that his cause of death conclusion was a determination of exclusion and was based largely on the circumstances of how Brendan's body was found, as opposed to findings during the autopsy. He questioned Dr. Fagan about all of the things he did not examine closely or test. The pathologist admitted that he never swabbed to see if there was evidence of a sexual assault, because he saw no physical signs of a sexual assault. He said he did not look for DNA on Brendan, including underneath his fingernails, and he ran a limited toxicology test, instead of a comprehensive one. Defence Fushino pointed out that Dr. Fagan had performed an autopsy in 1997, in the infamous Boston Nanny case. After Dr. Fagan changed his testimony about the death in this case, a judge changed the jury's verdict from murder to manslaughter. He also mentioned another 1997 case which involved a man who died from a seizure which he only began having after allegedly being kicked in the head by a student. Dr. Fagan had ruled the death a homicide, but the charge was later dropped when Dr. Fagan changed the manner of death to undetermined. After this case, Dr. Fagan had resigned when it was revealed he had failed to inspect the man's heart. Various items were sent to the New Jersey State Police Lab for DNA testing. However, the items didn't include Brendan's pajamas. Detective Bill Rummel had collected the pajamas, but said that he did not go over them closely before putting them in evidence storage. He said he had assumed that they were going to be sent to the lab for testing. Unfortunately, however, they weren't. The prosecution had argued that somebody carried Brendan to the spot where he was found, yet they failed to DNA test his pajamas. This was a colossal error. Patricia Toulon, a retired captain and former head of the Camden County Prosecutor's Office, said that she directed investigators to canvass the neighbourhood and question local sex offenders. When asked about the pajamas being tested, she said, "I probably should have oversaw that and made sure they were sent." Later, however, she said that she wouldn't have tested them because they had been submerged in the stream, and in her experience, there probably wouldn't have been any DNA evidence left. It was never revealed who had made the decision not to test the pajamas. A lot of people in attendance had been anticipating the testimony of Julie. She had not yet spoken publicly about her role in the case or her relationship with David. Prosecutor Shah first questioned Julie during the trial without the jury present, as Julie's attorney, Joseph Sorrentino, stood to the side. The purpose was to go over Julie's testimony. During the questioning, Julie refused to answer a number of questions and invoked the Fifth Amendment. This led to Judge John Kelly ordering her to answer the questions. Among these questions was whether Julie was upset that Brendan was at David's apartment the weekend she visited him before his death. She replied that she was upset that Brendan was there, and acknowledged that she had been considering breaking up with David over the weekend. Throughout the relationship, Julie had posted horrific things about Brendan on her Tumblr blog. She had called Brendan a mistake, and said that he would force David to stay in New Jersey forever. Around 10 weeks into the relationship, she had posted on Tumblr in regards to Brendan, "He is still a mistake, your mistake." Julie testified that she and David slept in the bedroom with the door closed, and Brendan slept on the couch in the living room. She said that sometimes she could hear Brendan, who had asthma, coughing through the door at night. She said that David had been struggling financially and was behind on payments for Brendan's preschool, and that when they went out for dinner, she often paid. She had suggested to David that his parents take custody of Brendan, to which David refused, stating that Brendan would always be a part of his life.
I thought, for the most part, I mean, he was a good father. He tried his best. He would cook for his son. He would, if his son needed to use the restroom, he needed help, he'd go with him. He gave him toys and stuff to play with. He took out all the toys in the apartment when Brendan was over. We would go on walks and stuff sometimes. One time we went to the aquarium. In general, DJ was a good parent in my eyes.
When Defence Fushino asked Julie if she would ever tell David to kill Brendan, she replied, "Absolutely not." She revealed that David had her passwords for Tumblr and Snapchat, and would often sign into them and check what she was doing. She said that he was extremely jealous and a bit paranoid as well.
due to his past relationships and having been cheated on, what he normally would do is he would check my phone a lot. He had access to that. He normally did it when I was around. But he also knew my passwords to my social media accounts. So theoretically, he could check my social media accounts at any time, with me there or not.
What social media accounts did you have at that time?
I believe I had Tumblr, Facebook, Snapchat. I believe that's all.
And those social media accounts, are they were password protected?
Yeah, they had a password.
Okay, and did you tell him what the password was?
Yeah, he knew.
And were you aware that he was checking your social media accounts?
I wasn't really made aware of this.
Did you allow him to do it if he wanted to do it in front of you?
Of course.
Okay. Did the defendant appear to you to be jealous of people you were talking to in school?
He sometimes came off that way, yes.
Okay, and can you explain that for us? What would he do that would make you think he was being jealous?
Well, he would always ask me, you know, what are you talking about? Why is this guy talking to you? Where did you guys hang out? Well, did you hang out somewhere? What did you do? You know, he would maybe even ask, why did he ask you for help instead of somebody else?
Okay.
The night that Brandon vanished, Julie said she went to bed at 8:30 p.m. because she had a test the following morning and she put her phone on silent. David seemingly became suspicious that she was going to bed so early and believed that she may have been out with another man or talking to another man. That night, David called Julie 10 times, but since her phone was on silent, she never answered. She said at the weekend she had been annoyed that David couldn't pick her up at the train station and that he had custody of Brandon that weekend. She said, "My logic at the time was I believed I was coming down, you know, sacrificing my weekends in New York to be with David. I was 17 at the time and I just didn't think I was ready for the responsibility of caring for another woman's toddler." Prosecutors would present a number of text messages between David and Julie to highlight the deterioration of their relationship and David's desperation to keep Julie from breaking up with him. David had texted Julie, "I care about you so fucking much. I'm willing to do anything." Julie demanded that she be David's number one priority, and he defended Brandon, stating, "He's in my life and I will never leave him. If you don't accept him, you don't accept me." He had also texted her that he didn't consider his son to be a mistake, which is probably in reference to Julie's Tumblr post. In another message she had written, "Here's what you need to understand. I don't want to spend my precious time near your kid, or near any kid for that matter." Julie would repeatedly ask David why he still talked to Samantha, and David said that he had to because they had a son together and shared custody. At one point, David texted Julie to say he wasn't happy, that she was going to lunch with a guy, and told her to find a friend who is a girl instead. In one message, Julie had asked when Brandon would be out of David's life, and questioned how long she would have to wait. The prosecution presented their case for almost 10 days. The defense would present their case in just 20 minutes. They called on 8 character witnesses, all of whom were friends and family of David. They asked them all the same questions. What is David's reputation for peacefulness? What is his reputation for honesty? All 8 witnesses would defend David, stating that they could trust him and that he was a very calm and peaceful person. Defense lawyers would ask that the murder charge be thrown out due to lack of physical evidence, but the judge refused and the trial moved forward to closing arguments. The defense would argue that the prosecution had failed to prove that David had killed his son. Defense Fushino stressed that prosecutors had to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. Not probably, not could have, not might have. He suggested the prosecutors had been grasping at straws to implicate somebody in Brandon's death and end the mystery. He said, in the face of tragedy, no one wants a mystery. Prosecutors refuted this and said that there was no reasonable doubt, adding that David had the motive, the opportunity, and the means to kill his son. They noted that he was the only person with Brandon the night he vanished. Prosecutor Shah said that at first David had defended his son, but then a week before he disappeared, he had texted Julie, "I'm willing to do anything or change anything for you." She suggested that the night Brandon vanished, David had been so upset that Julie was not responding to him that he walked into the living room, stuck a pillow over Brandon's face, and smothered him. The prosecution had truly faced an uphill battle. Their entire case was circumstantial. There had been no DNA evidence, no eyewitnesses, and no video surveillance. The medical examiner could not determine for sure whether Brandon had died from asphyxiation, drowning, or strangulation. The jury would deliberate for 5 days before stating that they could not reach a verdict. Judge John Kelly declared a mistrial. Prosecutors announced that they would be retrying the case. Outside of court, Defence Fusino said that he was appreciative of the jury's decision, but said that he wasn't surprised. Following the announcement, it would be revealed that 10 out of 12 jurors believed that David had murdered his son. One juror said to the Philadelphia Daily News, "It was our job to look at what was there and find some justice for this baby, for this family, and we didn't do it. I just don't feel that justice was served." The juror said that the inconsistencies in David's story, such as the lie that he went to sleep at 10:30 p.m., had led them to believe that he was guilty. They also believed that only David could have placed Brandon that deep into the woods where his body was found, and that he couldn't have wandered there on his own. In August, David would plead guilty to aggravated manslaughter. His change of plea came just weeks before he was due to stand trial again on the same charges. He admitted in court that he recklessly caused his son's death, under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life, by depriving Brandon of oxygen. In exchange for the plea, David was sentenced to just 10 years in prison, and would be eligible for parole in 8.5 years. It was a far cry from the 30 years to life sentence he would have received if he were convicted of Brandon's murder. When asked if he had anything to say, he simply replied no. Circumstantial evidence can often be like a puzzle. If you have all of the correct pieces, it will paint a full picture. Ultimately, the crux of this tragic case was that Brandon Criado had become an obstacle in the relationship his father was having with a teenage girl who cared only for herself. Julie Stensky was never charged in relation to Brandon's murder. A couple of days after David Criado Jr. was handed down his sentence, an anonymous person left a laminated note on the memorial bench for Brandon, which poignantly read, "Do not think of his final thoughts, hopefully painless, when he did not understand what was happening to him by whom. Someday, at some time, the person that would do the unthinkable will be brought to justice, either here on earth or later." Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Mel, Samantha, and Cherish. If you'd like to support the show on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In return for your support, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, merch, ad-free, and early release episodes, behind the scenes, and much more. As you know, Morbidology is a one-woman team, and I am eternally grateful for the support. You can join for as little as $1 a month, and you can cancel any time. There's absolutely no obligations to stay. You can also sign up annually to get 15% off. But I also ask a massive, massive favour, and ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, could you please consider leaving me a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like, and I love to read them. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Tapes from the Dark Side. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Season 3 of Tapes from the Dark Side.
Gilchrist County 911, what's the address of the emergency?
Brings you a new tale of true crime.
Yes, ma'am. I just shot my daughter and shot all my grandkids. And I'll be sitting on my step. And then when you get here, I'm going to shoot myself.
Tapes from the Dark Side is a serialized true crime podcast. Each season, we take one case and investigate in depth, using original source audio and legal documentation to break down exactly what occurred, the potential motive behind each crime, and the judicial implications for those involved. This is Season 3, The Spirit Family Massacre.
I think everyone has a bit of a fascination with the dark side.